everybody. Thank you for downloading and listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. Before we get into today's episode, we are going to chat about an event that's about to happen in North Hills, Raleigh. With me today, we have Chef Alex Ricci of Mura North Hills and Jesse Cortez, brand manager and mixologist of Bedlam Vodka. Hello, gentlemen.
What's going on, dude?
What's up, bud?
It's great to see you.
Awesome to have you in studio. You have a big event coming up. Chef, before we get into it, there's also a third guy in this room. Who do we have here and why?
Well, we got Bobby McFarland. I know he's a damn good cook, and I couldn't really think of anybody better to, you know, throw down on this event with me. So
that's right. Yeah. Friend of the show, Snobby McFarland.
I'll never escape that, will I?
Please tell me that's your Instagram handle.
It is not.
Oh, dude.
It will be.
You think it'll get me some followers?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. All right. Absolutely.
That's a solid name.
Chef beforehand.
So, Bobby, you brought this to my attention. This is pretty cool. The event itself is called Fire and Ice, and it's happening on January 31st at Mura, which is in North Hills, Raleigh. What is this all about? Maybe you and Chef can explain what's going on with Fire and Ice.
Well, I think it ties back to a more traditional Japanese celebration, and I think that's kind of where you guys started the thought process on this.
Conceptually, I think Jesse and I started putting this together about 2 years ago when we had lived together.
Yeah, I think what's going to be really cool about it is, and hopefully the unique thing, is that there's going to be essentially 4 or 5 different stations where something different is going to be happening live in front of you. So Alex is going to be outside,
yep,
actually cooking with different types or sources of fire. We're going to have a giant block of ice that we'll be carving ice cubes off of for some of the drinks.
Oh, wow.
Wall, our head sushi chef, guy's phenomenally talented. He's going to be handling the live sashimi carving for people.
So breaking down a whole fish in person.
Wow.
Yeah.
And then actual different bar stations where we're going to be making different cocktails.
Yeah.
So the idea being come in and mingle and try new things, meet new people, and hopefully learn as much as you enjoy the combination of different types of fire and what that does to the food and different types of ice and what that does to your drink.
How does sushi pair with vodka?
I think for people, you know, there's one of the first things that pops into people's head when they think about Bedlam is that it's made from rice and how that connects to, you know, rice,
yeah,
and Japanese cooking and sake specifically. Contextually, that's the closest cousin, really. They're different in a lot of ways. The rice that we use is different from sake rice. It's actually distilled where sake isn't distilled, as well as a couple other things. And so I think it's the quality of the vodka itself and looking at that as almost like a canvas for the cocktail. And then when you look at sushi and how sushi highlights, and especially the type of sushi that they do at Mura, it's just damn good quality fish.
So the event is Thursday, January 31st from 6 to 9. So you do a hard day of work, all you listeners out there. You start driving home. Of course, you got the NCFMB podcast on the radio as you drive and head to North Hills. Tickets are $70, which isn't too bad considering you're drinking vodka, you're getting live sushi being made in front of you, and it's indoor-outdoor. If you haven't been to Mura, it truly is an amazing experience. This is also for a charity, you said?
Yeah, so the proceeds are going to the Tammy Lynn Center.
Oh, fantastic.
Yeah.
How do we find tickets?
Just head over to bedlamvodka.com/ice, I-C-E, and you can get information about the event, the link to buy tickets, and learn a little bit more in detail about what we're actually going to be doing for everyone.
Awesome. So we'll put show notes to that. That's bedlamvodka.com/ice to get tickets for the Fire and Ice event featuring Mura and Bedlam Thursday, January 31st from 6 to 9 at Mura in North Hills, Raleigh. Come check it out.
You're listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast, coming to you from the kitchen studios located high atop the historic Raleigh building located in the heart of downtown Raleigh. The NCF&B podcast takes you behind the scenes of North Carolina's food and beverage industry. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at NCFBpod. This episode is sponsored in part by Food Scene. That's food, SEEN.com. Providing professional photography, social media management, video production, and website design. That's Food Scene. And now, the sommeliers to the stars, the bar backs in your backyard, it is Max and Matt.
Hello, and thank you for listening to the North Carolina Food and Beverage Podcast. I am your co-host, Max Trujillo.
And I am your co-host, Matthew Weiss. And today we are lucky enough to snag a few moments with the co-founder and executive director of the PCG. Visiting the Triangle today is Ms. Chris Reed.
Hello, guys. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you.
And board member and Charlotte PR badass, Rachel Sutherland of Rachel Sutherland Communications.
I'm glad that you swore, because that's pretty much what I do. So
that's what all PR people do.
Excellent, yes.
Yeah. Welcome to Raleigh.
Yeah.
Thank you. I love the city.
Yeah, I think the last time that, the first time that Rachel became a friend of the podcast was when we were getting our Order Fire episodes set up with Mark Jacksina, and we also spoke with Birdsong Brewery, which was fantastic. We had an excellent little weekend out there in Charlotte. It's always fun to go there. And then I went back to Charlotte to bartend the NC
bartending
the showdown with NCRLA. And Chris and I, we were just gabbing on and on about cocktails.
Just drinking and talking.
All right. Let's get into it. You are in the Triangle, more notably, you're here in Raleigh kind of for a specific reason, because you are, as Matt mentioned, the co-founder of the PCG, the Piedmont Culinary Guild. You have purpose here. I think the first part is, tell us, what the hell is the Piedmont Culinary Guild?
So PCG is a collection of chefs, farmers, artisan purveyors, so those are food and beverage craftspeople, culinary professionals across the spectrum, all working to preserve the flavors of the Piedmont. So the idea is that if we're not supporting small growers and the flavors that exist here with authenticity, that we're going to lose those flavors and those experiences. So PCG started in Charlotte with myself when I was chefing and a couple of other chefs that were sort of sharing purveyor resource and labor resource, and realized, like, if this is working for us, we must open this up to more people, because this is going so well, being able to cross-train employees. This was right at the beginning of the labor crisis, and share purveyors and share experiences and education with each other. So we sat down with 30 of the leaders in Charlotte, some of them like super old school, like Bruce Moffitt, and some of them New World. And decided that day, we need to create some kind of organization, some kind of structure here to be able to more easily collaborate and create opportunities to, you know, tighten the weave on the fabric around the food community.
So before we even get deeper into that story, let's define for a second, because there's a lot of people that live outside of North Carolina,
sure,
and maybe even people that live inside North Carolina is, wait, Piedmont, what does it have to do with Northern Italy? Actually nothing. So
Piedmont means foothill.
So there's three distinct areas of North Carolina. So you have actually Mountain Foothill, then you have your Piedmont, and then you have coastal. So we do identify ourselves sort of in that space between the coast and the mountains, stretching down in South Carolina. We don't have any members in Virginia, although the Piedmont technically does go up into Virginia. But our focus has been really in Charlotte as the base, and kind of looking out around that space in the Piedmont. So, but yes, the Piedmont of Italy, I say all the time to people, you know, why couldn't the Piedmont of North Carolina be the Piedmont of Italy? You know, we have unique flavor experiences. We have a long growing season. We have brewers, distillers, vintners, amazing talent, lots of innovation around agriculture. Why couldn't this be a culinary destination for people to come to around the world and experience these different flavors?
I guess we're just missing those white truffles.
We have truffle production.
Yeah.
It's happening.
Whoa.
Yeah.
And our Barolo is delicious here.
Who's making truffles? Where are they coming from?
First harvest actually just happened, I think, last week. So Clark Barlow.
Of course, Clark Barlow.
Clark posted that up. Somebody made an investment 10 years ago, and
you know what? Now that
taken.
You say, I saw this post. He said, who would have ever thought that we could get this in the truck?
And now it's happening.
Yeah. It started out in Charlotte.
Yep.
It was kind of Charlotte-centric for a long time.
Very Charlotte-centric,
So I'm happy to see. Well, what took so long to get over the Triangle?
So we had a lot of interest in other communities that wanted to be involved, but sort of the idea of sharing resources as the primary pillar of the organization, you know, when you have people on a thread saying, I need 5 pounds of Anson Mill grits, you're not going to drive those from Raleigh to a chef in Charlotte. So the hyper sharing part of the organization is really important. So to expand into other markets or other areas, it required that we really think about, is this sort of like we're the umbrella and we create sister guilds, or do we create chapters? And I don't know what you know about Slow Food, but Slow Food did the chapter route. And we can kind of see what's happened with Slow Food at this point. It's really lost a lot of traction at this point. I think that their branding got really washed, and opening up new chapters, people get to take advantage of that and sort of pursue whatever is interesting to that unique area, which is cool. But again, there is some brand washing there, and I think what ended up happening is they lost a lot of following. So we decided not to go chapter route. We decided to go sister guild. So there is only one PCG. It's the 501. And then we're opening up these sister guilds, which will operate out of the 501 that is existing. So they won't open up their own 501. So we started in Winston-Salem because Travis Myers, he won NCRLA Chef Showdown last year.
That's right.
He joined our board almost 2 years ago. And Travis had a lot of interest in sort of creating this network in the Winston-Salem area, which is the triad. So it's Winston-Salem, High Point, Greensboro, all of those chefs and farmers also working together. So they were our first sister guild, and that that's going great. So we have 250 pro members in Charlotte. We got like 40 up in the triad. And then we had a lot of interest in this market. So we decided to come here. And so we launched yesterday at the Haymaker. We had, 17 people come out and sit down and learn about the guild and talk about some of the unique challenges to this area in terms of barriers for local food and also the strengths of local food here. You have a much different demographic here than we have in Charlotte and also in the Triad. So there's a lot of opportunity to customize what the PCG is doing in this market to make it beneficial for farmers and chefs.
Who is heading up sort of the PCG of the Triangle?
So Clayton Anderson from the Whiskey Kitchen volunteered himself last night.
Nice.
Thanks,
He's
Chef.
Like, oh, shit.
Man, did I really do that?
What did I do?
He
brought a lot of whiskey.
He really did. He's already got bombarded with emails this morning. So,
that's great. And the Whiskey Kitchen itself is such a great central, localized place. Like, that's a good starting ground for everyone to kind of connect.
Yeah.
Plus, they have a huge space. And I have to say, I ate there maybe 3 weeks ago.
It's awesome.
Tasty.
It's really good. I mean,
tasty.
A lot more than what you would expect for like a whiskey bar, quote unquote.
Right.
Yeah, that's the I love the example of, speak softly, carry a big stick. That's who those guys are, because they talk about whiskey, and then by the way, they just throw down like a Brunswick stew or something that you wouldn't expect.
Right.
That is delicious,
Right. And they're doing a lot of local sourcing. So, again, we needed some leadership in this area that has already bought into this idea.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly they're going to be a great player for us to help bring the community together. So,
well, I want to get a little deeper into you, Chris. Who are you? Obviously, we know that you were in Los Angeles, supposedly, but not really. And then we'll transform that to get back into this path, because I think your path has a lot to do with why you are heading up the Piedmont Culinary Guild and all. What's interesting, I noticed in reading your bio, was that you studied in Guadalajara, Mexico, and that's where your kind of culinary education started.
Mm-hmm.
So I got to ask, where was the need, and what was the need for you to go to Mexico to learn? Or to start your education in food?
So when I left college the first time, I was in the accounting world, and I found accounting really dull. I worked for a firm in Los Angeles.
Can't imagine why.
Let's count in Spanish. Uno, dos.
I
gotta go to school.
I really struggled with it. It was like just silent air conditioning office, moving one pile of paperwork to the other side of the desk every day. And I loved to cook, and I did a lot of parties, and people were like, you should cook. Like, you should do this for a living. And so I started checking out culinary schools. Johnson & Wales was coming to Charlotte at the time. My parents had moved here, and so I applied, which, there's really, like, you don't get approved. Like, they just take your money. They don't care. They really don't. They don't really give a shit about your qualifications.
Yeah.
I hate to say it, but it's true. I mean, they're a business, It's true. And, I love that school, and they've been a great partner to us in Charlotte for the Guild and for myself personally and professionally. But at the time, it was just like, yeah, you're accepted. And I was like, cool. And they're like, we're going to need $24,000. And I was like, oh, well, I don't really make enough to write you a check for $24,000, but I made too much. to get financial aid.
Yeah.
So I was like, where can I go for a year off the books and then reapply for financial aid looking like a poor person? And it was like, oh, Mexico. I'll move to Mexico for a year. And that's what I did.
Wow.
So I started working at a bar at night to save money and got into the industry that way. And
can't do that anymore. There's a wall going up.
Yeah, right.
Have trouble getting back in.
Well, you know, the funny thing is, too, you know, my mom is Mexican, so she's half Mexican.
Okay.
And my tata never spoke Spanish in the house. He really wanted his family to be American, you know?
Sure.
So, like, you only really heard Spanish during, like, funerals and weddings. There was, like, the old world family and the new world family. The old world family is, like, drinking tequila, talking Spanish, smoking cigars. And the new world family was, like, playing Atari and drinking Coke and speaking English and making jokes. And so that was, like, the two worlds. But anyway, so I thought, well, I'll go to Mexico because I want to learn how to speak Spanish. It's part of my heritage. And I found a school down there where I could learn some Spanish. And the very first week in the school, the teacher asked, what are you doing here? And I said, well, I want to learn how to speak Spanish because it's part of my heritage. I also want to be a cook. And in L.A., like, if you don't speak Spanish, you're kind of you're handicapped.
You're screwed. You're going to go hungry.
Yeah, you're handicapped. So I was like, I'm learning, you know, I want to learn more kitchen language than anything else. And she's like, oh, my brother owns the culinary school in Jalisco. I'll introduce you. And so she took me over to the culinary school, and he's like, you should come to school here. And I said, well, I'm already paid this school over here to learn Spanish, so I don't really have any more money. And he said, well, how about you clean the labs every day, and then we'll trade you classes. And so I went to language school in the morning, then took a bus over to the culinary school, cleaned the labs, broke down fish, broke down meat, did whatever, and then I got to take evening classes there.
So nice.
It's funny when you think about Mexico in a culinary sense. I think only now, and I mean like over the last 5 years, is Mexico getting its due for being such a culinary mecca.
Mecca, yeah.
You can get anything. The guys from Noma closed for the summer or whatever. It opened up in like Cancun or just outside, I forget exactly, Punta Cana or something. But they opened up in Mexico to have like Noma 2 for a while. And you watch that, A Chef's Life or whatever it is on Netflix, and they're talking about it. And he's like, yeah, I want to go to the place where anything grows at any time of the year. Everything is fresh, the seafood, the meat, everything. It's a wet dream for chefs to be in Mexico. But contrary to all the negative press that it's received for so many years, that it's desolate and, you know, like a wasteland and all, it's like, no, no, no.
It's
Mexico's
a very
where
vibrant,
it's at.
It's a very vibrant community.
Yeah.
It's a wet dream for a chef mostly because you don't have all the food safety regulation in place.
Oh, that too,
so,
yeah.
Like,
yeah.
You know, you can, like, there's so much flexibility in culinary there.
Yeah. I'll just say for a
which
second.
Which is why innovation happens there, right? You have a lot of culinary innovation that happens there for that reason.
Necessity is the mother of all invention.
That's true.
Fact check, Punta Cana is in Dominican Republic. Just sorry, buddy.
I was going to say something.
But to validate what you're saying, for anybody who's curious about Mexican food and what Max is saying, you should watch the Ugly Delicious episode with David Chang and Tacos, because they explain about how Mexico became this, you know, unbelievable culinary destination. So just a recommendation.
There's an episode on that part of that Samin Nosrat show, the acid... Salt, fat, heat, acid.
Oh, yeah.
That is about Mexico, and it is spectacular.
Okay.
Like, I wanted to go right away. It was all about their use of it was the acid episode. It was all about their use of citrus and the different kinds. I had no idea that there were so many variations of citrus, and a lot of it is only available in Mexico. It was brilliant.
Ooh. I do
really
need
good.
A lot. You know, that just reminds me, total non sequitur, we need to do a show on everybody's favorite cooking show and just, like, review that.
Mm, yeah.
The Italy version or the Italy episode of that series too. It's only 4 episodes long, but the Italy one is incredible.
Okay, nice.
Yeah.
All right.
So when you were in Mexico then, as opposed to now, we're like talking about this, like it's so progressive and all. I imagine it probably wasn't that when you were going to school.
So it was 2004.
Yeah. So
I would say the biggest culture shock on the culinary side was sort of the food safety. Like Dia de Carne, when they brought the meat to the school, it was literally the back of a truck opened up and there was just dead carcasses in it. And it was like throwing those bloody boxes out into the basement. And then the chef came down. He's like, here, break down this pig. And I'm like, you know, the fan is like ting, 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 ting. And I'm about to pass out just from the sight of all of it.
But that's the way it was when I was in France over the summer.
Right.
In all the supermarkets, there are flies everywhere. There's really no refrigeration. None of the milk is refrigerated.
It works for
None
them.
Of the eggs are refrigerated.
It works for them. Super fresh. It was delicious. Everything I had there was fabulous.
Yeah.
You know, people are like, oh, I don't want to get sick. I actually lived there for 6 months before I got sick. So And I knew when I
ate... That was just tequila.
I wish it was. That was like 17 pounds in 3 days. It was pretty awesome. If I could bottle that up and bring it to America, I'd be a millionaire. You know what I mean? Yeah.
The Mexico diet.
Montezuma's revenge.
Yeah.
Okay, but so while you're there,
yeah.
You must have noticed this imbalance. You must have noticed poverty while you were in Mexico,
sure.
Because of the imbalance there.
Yeah.
And I want to bring it back to North Carolina because... the fact that you're working, you're the leader of the PCG, the Piedmont Culinary Guild, that leads me to wonder then, so what are some of the biggest problems that our state is having, and how do you position yourself with that? Because we've talked about it ad nauseum on this show, and just in general, that North Carolina has this thriving culinary scene, but then at the exact same time, we are rife with food deserts mm-hmm. all over. And so... I would love to know your opinion on like how that maybe and maybe being in Mexico might have had some influence of seeing that or just being in North Carolina.
I do want to hear what you have to say, but first I want to tell you where there's not a desert of anything.
Okay.
Because you can find them in four locations around North Carolina.
Go ahead and do the plug.
It's the Triangle Wine Company.
There you go.
So if you need wine,
well done.
Beer.
Dump.
It mixers for your bar. The guys from Triangle Wine Company have it all. Plus, if you use the NCFB promo code, 10% discount. And they have locations in Cary, in Southern Pines, all the way out there. Then open now, I believe, in Holly Springs.
What?
And Morrisville. Yeah.
It's open.
It's open, baby. And also on the internet, they're huge. They have a great website, trianglewineco.com. That's trianglewineco.com. Go there, find all your needs.
Excellent.
You're nailing life.
Yes.
Trying.
We just got paid
I want this job.
$40,000 for that spot.
That's
right?
Amazing. I was like, I'm doing the wrong thing for a living.
Yeah.
What am I doing?
Well, what are you doing?
So what am I doing?
What a great segue right there. What
yeah.
are you doing? How does the PCG find itself inside of North Carolina, and how is it helping?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, that's an interesting conversation in terms of food deserts, food inequality, you know, and those topics of food access, because for whatever reason, we always bring the conversation of local food and food access together in one place, and it's really hard to reconcile that, because when we talk about local food, we're often talking about product that is more expensive. Mm-hmm. It typically is attracting a more affluent audience. At the farmer's market or at the restaurants. I mean, McDonald's is not selling local fried potatoes. So there's a different community that supports local food. And when we talk about food access, that's another segment of the population that needs to be addressed. Is it addressed with local food? This is kind of this weird reconciliation problem that we often have.
Yeah.
It's the same reconciliation problem that we have when we talk about sustainability. So, like, we talked about this last night. You know, it's like we need to set the table and have a real conversation and define what the hell that even means. But food access is a super important issue in Charlotte right now, and it's being addressed through the Bulb and multiple organizations that are helping to move product from restaurants or other organizations and institutions away from the waste stream and into the mouths of people that need that food. And so there certainly is a huge effort in our community. I don't know about this community because I'm just learning about the Triangle.
Sure.
But certainly there's an opportunity to bring clean, healthy food to food deserts, but it has to be done right now through organizations that are carrying that weight on their back. So, like the Bulb. So she's doing just a terrific job taking rescued food out into communities, doing pop-up farmers markets where it's donation only. Like, you can get 10 pounds of potatoes and, like, give her a dollar. So she's doing a beautiful job of getting this food out. She's also doing some cooking demos because a lot of people at this point, I mean, we're losing skill and craft, you know, and part of that is the fact that food is so cheap in this country. We're paying 8% of our income versus other countries that are paying, you know, 40-50% of their income to eat. They work every day just to make sure they can eat.
Mm-hmm.
We don't deal with that in America. So when the food is cheap, people can eat out three times a day. And that culture has separated us from not just farms, but from kitchens and knives and cutting boards and real skill to survival skill, you know.
And then you cut yourself on those cutting boards and then, oh, I have to pay for all of my health care.
Right.
And that's where they get you.
It's really broken. So, and I was on my way here to this to talk with you guys. I was talking to Dave Feemster. He's at Fahrenheit in Charlotte.
Mm-hmm.
And we were just discussing like this real serious labor crisis that we're in at this point. I mean, we saw it coming 10 years ago. The trajectory happened much sooner than it was supposed to hit.
Yeah.
It was supposed to be like 2020. We were going to be dealing with a lot of this stuff. The real impact started like 2016. And what I mean by labor crisis, I mean just shortage of labor. We're at 2.9% unemployment in Charlotte.
For restaurants,
culinary.
Yeah,
so 2.9% unemployment in Charlotte right now, 800 openings just in the hotel hospitality programs. So, you know, at this point, it's a super delicate thing because we're talking about to afford skilled labor, you'd have to raise menu prices. You raise the menu prices, that means less people are eating out. That has an impact on restaurant industry. So this is like a conundrum that we're really trying to figure out right now and trying to be innovative around this in the PCG space, talking with chefs and really trying to figure out like how are we going to overcome some of this stuff, because we can't just do the chef shuffle where we're moving this sous chef over to this restaurant and this pastry chef goes over here now. And, you know, we've just been doing this shuffle in Charlotte, but people are burning out. And so people are leaving the shuffle and there's no one coming back into the mix. And so it's really created a lot of stress and duress for our chefs, for our chef community.
So I think this is such an all-encompassing topic, because I think Max and I, and we always make the allusion to Max when he was running restaurants. He would always tell me that, you know, I got to work Garmanger because I can't find people to work there. So I'm not only general managing, and I hear this story over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And I think it's interesting because I think it ties in with your background, and we'll cut to it. When you came to Charlotte, you started this big thing about changing over institutionalized programs, and that can be anything from a school to a retirement home to a hospital to a blah, 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 into using these foods. So the way that I'm thinking and I'm getting there is we need more jobs in it. Well, the way, and especially with the millennial shift in this country, the way that more people get into the jobs, and the big thing is quality of life.
Yeah.
And it's been known for a long time that quality of life is not, don't work in the restaurant
Labor's
industry
totally
if you want quality
exploited
of life.
In the restaurant industry.
So my thought in going there and equating it to your institutional is often in institutional or state-run facilities, blah, 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 you have set hours that you can work, right? It's only 8 hours you can work a week, and then you start to go into overtime. So I'm thinking that if we can put more focus on those institutionalized programs, get people working in there, and then at least that starts the quality of life idea in the industry, maybe that would be a huge boon to the employment of
There's pros and cons on farm to institution. I mean, yes, I've been working on that over 10 years in Charlotte and have made huge strides, I feel like, at this point with how we handle farm to institution in North Carolina and especially this region. But, you know, one of the challenges when you ask somebody who's a creative to go into more of a collaborative environment, that's, you know, you come to culinary as an artist.
Mm.
You know, most chefs are actually artists, so of some form or another. I mean, Mark Jacksina, for example. I mean, I don't know if you know about his pottery. Jesus, I mean, his pottery is beautiful. So, you know, a lot of them have an artistic eye. So they're looking at things. They're looking at the world differently. And a lot of institutions are run like checkbox and, you know, really structured. And it's hard for people that are creatives to operate in a space like that.
Mm-hmm.
So there's this weird sort of, sounds like... I didn't make it. I made it for 4.5 years.
Yeah. but you bring up a good point, though, because it to revitalize an industry to be almost more corporate or structured would there in turn take away the sexiness of what the industry is at its own side.
Right.
Like most, put it this way, a lot of servers, bartenders, especially back when we were in Los Angeles, you worked that job. Matt and I both, we worked those jobs because we were trying to do something else. We were trying to make it as an actor or a musician.
Exactly.
And this
was
a part-time way to make a buck.
That's right. It wasn't a career.
But go to Los Angeles for an example. They had minimum wage rules and regulations for, say, the front of the house. Now, most people don't cry too much for front of the house servers because they just have this feeling that everyone's making a ton of money.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not the case. But there are opportunities to make a ton of money. But then usually... once somebody starts making real money, the management hires another two or three servers to crowd the floor, and then it all just kind of evens out.
Right.
But, you know, I've mentioned it before, but it bears repeating. Listeners, while you're driving right now, do you know what the minimum wage is for a server in a restaurant in North Carolina? It's $2.13
an hour.
You spent more on a gallon of gas just now while listening to this show. So it's $2.13 an hour, and then you make tips. But let's be honest, if you're not at Crawford & Son or the Umstead or any of Ashley Christensen's restaurants, and you're just working at a regular place, you know, you may make $30 in tips that day for lunch.
Or you might not make anything. If there's a weather event or there's something that happens, your income is screwed. And so I agree with you. People have often said that about the front of the house, but at least the back of the house, you're getting your check.
Yeah.
For the hours that you're there.
Yeah.
You know, living wages right now, quote, quote, is like $13.25 an hour. That's right. Living wage. There's very few entry-level positions in a kitchen that start at $13.25
an hour.
We just
had this conversation with Maggie Kane, who's running a place at the table. She was on last week, and she's paying $15 an hour as that. And I, as a GM, would never hire a line cook unless they had so much experience and pretty much could take on leadership roles for more than, say, $12 an hour.
Right.
And then if they'd been there for 6-7 months, a year, maybe we're talking about $13 an hour. And that's like the best employee I can find. And how can you live off
that?
If you have a kid, like, how could you live off that?
I was just talking to David on the way up here, Chef Dave, and when I was mentioning that we're talking about the labor crisis, and I said, you know, I really feel at this point that we're going to, first of all, there's going to be an adjustment. Something is about to happen in our industry. It's been building for a while, so we are about to have a price adjustment. Now, that price adjustment may come on menus, or it may come in other ways, like restaurants eliminating high-level skilled positions or salary positions, like executive chefs, like pastry chefs, and contracting that out. So a chef comes in, they build a menu, they build all the sources, they build the order guide, they do the costing for you, they train. Now you're paying a line cook $18 an hour, so you can bring in higher skilled labor on the day-to-day, and then you're only contracting out seasonally on your menu. I really think that's the shift that's about to happen. There's two chefs in the Charlotte market already doing this. I thought this would be like 2025. Again, like this trajectory on how things have happened is like really has been much more condensed and consolidated than what I think a lot of people were thinking 10 or 15 years ago when we were all talking about this and seeing this train wreck coming down the pipeline.
I can see that happen for a very specific sect of areas. But let's go back to the creative side, right?
Right.
This is an art.
Yeah.
How many times have Matt and I and anyone else, again, listening to our audience, who many of them find themselves working in the business, like for one, getting back to the labor pool, anyone listening right now that has ever applied for a job or had to hire for those positions, have you had a hard time finding a dishwasher recently or a strong line cook?
But would you if you were paying them $18 an hour, Max? That's kind of what I'm saying. If you're paying $18, now we've provided a benefit to coming into this industry, because right now we're like, yeah, come work your ass off. Come be treated like shit by most people.
Yeah.
Come make nothing and be grateful for it.
But
I mean, like, that's crazy.
The counter argument, though, that I'm just going to say is if you're a creative, as we mentioned before, you want to open up your own place.
Right.
You want to be your chef.
Sure.
You want to be yourself.
But design your own menu.
Sure.
Right. There are amazing line cooks that I've worked with. I mean, hell, Blake Gottlieb, he's about to open up Under the Oak Cafe, right? Blake was the best line cook at Standard Foods for the longest time, started doing catering, now he's opening his restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
Kudos to him. But it took him to do that. So then, is he not allowed to open a restaurant because some other chef that's like kind of well known needs to be the one that, like, who would sanction who gets to have restaurants and who's the chef that?
It's a capitalist society. You do whatever the hell you want to do. I mean, you want to come in and compete, but be ready to compete at a price point that you can actually pay living wages and not $13.25 an hour, because that's not a living wage.
Yeah. You know, so this is a fascinating discussion. It's such a new perspective on it. But I was thinking when reading your bio as well and thinking about my life and a lot of people that I know, I think that restaurants are at the forefront, obviously, of creating this local food farm movement, right?
Absolutely.
Whereas I think, and you probably, just bear with me because you'll probably have a different opinion on this, but I think that in the home, while some people are very focused on that, it's just not, we're not as focused, to be fair. You know, like, we will throw stuff in the microwave, we will shop at Costco because we're, you know, if you're a two-income family, both parents are working, children need food, it needs to happen quickly, and then the rest of the evening and you need to get back to work or whatever things happen. So, I've also heard that, you know, in my day job, I sell wine, so I'm always dealing with restaurants, and I'm talking to people, and they're like, yeah, we're busy. Our January is up so far.
Yep.
Our December was through the roof.
Mm-hmm.
And they're like, I guess it's true. People don't eat at home anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So in thinking, if that equates to restaurants being at the forefront of leading this local food and farm-to-table movement, mm-hmm. and then people will then be eating at restaurants more, and let's say it's not the job of necessarily the private home to be focused on that, although mm-hmm. we can be better, granted, then we are going to need more people in the workforce.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess then I'm coming back to this idea of we are going to need more labor in restaurants. There are more right. and more restaurants opening every day. And that chef who wants to open a restaurant can, but like you said, they need to open a living, pay a living wage.
Right.
But they're also going to get the influx of money of all these people eating at the restaurants more often.
That's if people can afford to eat at the restaurant with them paying a living wage and buying quality ingredients.
Yes. Yes.
Right, because then that means that your typical lunch of $14 a
is now $24.
Yeah, or may split the difference. But, right. yeah, it's going to be in there. It's what happened, it's Matt, when you and I expensive. Ate at Danny Meyer's restaurants, when we ate at Gramercy Tavern where the tax or the tip is built in.
Yes.
It was like, granted, we were in New York, and it's yeah. going to be expensive no matter what. But that glass of rosé we had, which you and I both knew the value
from
of that
$12
glass,
to $14 or $16,
yeah,
you buy the glass, something like that.
But, like,
but I don't know if that's necessarily what you're talking about. You're talking about building the tip into the price?
No,
just saying, I'm not talking about
anything.
I'm talking about
food.
Raising the prices of everything, because as right now what's happening is chefs that are buying quality ingredients are having to make a choice, right? There's only a certain amount in the pie. You know, you're paying 30%. Right. You're losing 30. You're doing 30% on your staffing or your, you know, whatever, however your percentages work. But let's say that you're trying to hit the 25% food cost number,
yeah.
you know, for
which
like,
is, like impossible,
which is nearly impossible at this point. But like, I love to use this example with local chicken. You know, a local chicken right now costs $20. So
it's
if you
insane.
Do if you do half of a chicken on a plate,
yeah.
okay, that's $10. Mm-hmm. Times four is $40. That's 25% food cost. No person is going to walk in and eat half a chicken with no sides for $40.
Right.
Yeah.
So
no
the
way.
Local argument becomes really difficult, because if we're sourcing quality ingredients, we have to not be paying as much on the labor. Or if we're paying more on the labor, we need to bring that, because there's only so much room in that profit pie.
Right.
So the big thing with PCG right now is like, how do we get the chefs to get on board with raising the damn prices? Because we want them sourcing good ingredients and we want them paying living wages. That means the consumer has to bear the burden of this. So when you talk about just a minute ago, when you're like, oh, what's, you know, we need more people coming in because we're going to have all these restaurants opening because everyone's eating out more often.
Well, I'm saying hold on.
Right.
I'm saying theoretically,
right.
more people are eating out more often,
sure.
thus that will be more influx
sure.
of money.
They wouldn't be eating out breakfast, lunch, and dinner, though, if they were paying the real cost of
right.
food. And when I say the real cost of food, I mean, go to the farmer's market and buy food. That is actually the current market value of food. When you go to the grocery store, that is not
that's
market
surreal.
Value.
Yeah.
That is totally artificially priced.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, from
that's where the grocery stores.
We
have
could talk
their
for days
on
that.
The neck of
right.
the farmer.
That's right.
To get that.
Yeah.
Produce
I mean,
down.
Dairy, all of it.
Yeah.
It's artificial numbers. It means absolutely nothing. The consumer pays for it in tax subsidies. They don't even realize it. So if you want to understand the value of food, go to the farmer's market. Pay real American dollars for it. That's how much it costs to bring food to the market. Now take that food and try to make money in the restaurant industry using that food.
It's impossible.
So it's not impossible if we're charging what we need to charge for the meals. It's impossible with the price structure the way that it is now. What you're seeing in Charlotte is a glut of restaurants coming in, especially concepts from outside of Charlotte, Atlanta, whatever, coming in with their priced menus where they should be for the market.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So they're making money and they're paying their line cooks $18 an hour.
Mm-hmm.
But you have tenured restaurants there that if they raise their prices 25%, consumers would be like deuces. They wouldn't eat there and they'd complain about it. So they can't do the price adjustments quick enough at this point
right.
to catch up
right.
with these guys that are coming in from out of town with their menu already priced. They would be better to shut their fucking their stupid restaurants down.
Say it.
Sorry.
It accentuates
sorry.
The point, no.
yeah.
you, but they would be better to shut their restaurants down for a period of time and reopen under a new concept with their menu priced accordingly.
Right.
You know, because that's what we're dealing with.
You yeah. can't change the consumer's
you
mind that quickly.
You can't change the
yeah.
consumer. And I'll say this, too. I wanted to point out, you said something about like, oh, yeah, we were busy in December. We were busy. We had, you know, everyone's eating out. But cash flow doesn't mean profitability, you know. And that's a big misconception, too, for people that walk in a restaurant and see it busy. Just because they're busy,
mm-hmm.
they're just they might be losing money faster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they're losing 25 cents on every
true
plate,
words have not
they're
been
just
spoken.
Yeah, they're just losing money faster. They're
mm-hmm.
not making money faster.
Yeah. And so when I was building a budget for restaurants, there's this like 30-30-30-10 rule that a lot of people practice.
Right.
It's kind of an old rule, but it's still not too far off.
Right.
That you spend 30% of the money on the product you're buying
yep.
to sell.
Yep.
Then you 30% of it is on controlled, you know, your rent and your
sure.
power and all that.
Mm-hmm.
30% on your labor and
yep.
all that. And then what's left, you have 10%.
Yep.
10% is your profit.
Yeah.
So that.
But that gets usually eaten up.
Yeah, usually.
And you end
up
with like a 2%
oh,
profitability
yeah.
margin, maybe.
If you look
that's
at like
really
Restaurant
good.
Magazine, the
sure.
national magazine, they highlight the companies that do the best, right? And so they're like Darden,
right.
like the big, like the Olive Garden companies,
right.
they're running at like 12% profit.
Right.
And these are companies that are buying national, like Tyson chicken,
right.
and like the cheapest of the cheap on a large scale. And they're not even making that much money.
Right.
It's just they're making money because they have 1,000
right,
outlets.
Right.
So you start going down to the Ashley Christensens of the world that ethically work the right way and do
right.
like she pays people really well. They're also busy, so there's you know there are tips being generated, and
yep.
I know a lot of the back of the house guys that are happy to be there.
Yeah.
She is few and far between of what comes around, and
mm-hmm.
and I wouldn't go so far as to say Ashley's food is cheap. She's
mm-mm.
not, but she's not over the top pricey.
She's priced accordingly.
There's just not a lot of money to go around. It's
right.
not like Ashley's flying around in a Lear jet everywhere. No.
Right.
And she is the most successful chef in our state.
Right.
So, like.
Well, but we don't know how. I mean, we just to
how,
be fair, we don't know
how
the
do you
profitability.
Measure success?
Right. She's successful. Her food's great. She's
right.
lauded as a chef. We don't know the profitability of her restaurants.
Right.
No, but I'm saying you bring Ashley in here and she would say, yes, I'm sure I do well. But she is not like the next Steve Jobs, like
right.
crushing it. Meaning to say that just this industry itself does not have enough money to give out.
This industry
for profit.
Used to be profitable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my grandparents owned a deli. You know, my family was in the restaurant business for a long time. This used to be a profitable business model, like you were saying, the 30-30-10. Like that,
yeah.
that's for decades been the case.
Right.
But see, the market has shifted so quickly now. We have to get in front of it. We have to realize that that pie doesn't work anymore, and we got to figure out how are we going to make the adjustments or how are we going to extend that price to consumers without pissing people off.
Yeah.
And going back to the North Carolina product, going back to the Piedmont region, this region specifically, if we, you know, we are losing farms at a rapid rate at this point. We've lost over 50,000 farms since 75. You know, that right now is happening really fast. So if we're
50, not 50,000 farms in the state?
In
or?
This state.
Wow.
Since 1975, 50,000.
Are we losing them
rapier,
as individual businesses, or they're being like consumed by larger companies? Like the farmland's still there, but it's being owned by, say, like Tyson
farmers,
Chicken. And
farmers deal with just like the same with chefs. Do you think somebody wants to go sweat their ass off on a farm in the middle of August in North Carolina? No, they want to work retail at the Gap in air conditioning.
Right.
You know, so they can't compete with the labor pool right now at a price point that makes sense for their product. Their product's already super expensive
yeah.
with their current model, right? So that now they're dealing with what chefs are dealing with. So what I'm saying is we're about to hit a major correction with local food, whether that means we just see local food businesses completely go out because they can't compete. I'm not sure what's going to happen. Something's going to happen, though, and it's building to a crescendo right now.
Yeah.
So the farm thing is the same thing as the kitchen thing. You know, we have to figure out how do we pay for the price of real food? How do we get consumers to understand the value and integrity in this food? Why would you choose this food over commodity food? That's the message that needs to get out there. That's the message we need to be sharing. We need to convince eaters to eat the right thing.
Right. So I come back and my mind is turning around of this quality of life scenario in the restaurants. And you're
yep.
right. Nobody wants to sweat their ass off in the middle of August on a farm.
Yep.
But people do want to work in kitchens and they do want to be a part of restaurants to some degree.
Yep.
So I'm thinking, and I know some people have been at this, and maybe you have some examples of people who have done this. And I can't believe I'm about to say this, being a front of the house guy for most of my life. But it seems to me that restaurants need to work somewhat more of on a socialist platform where front of the house is sharing with back of the house in the tip pool, and thus
keep it going, Bernie.
Hold on,
oh, man.
But the,
Jesus
but
Christ.
The back of the house shares in the tip pool. They
Jimmy,
get some of that,
you a drink?
But they work. But they're able to work less hours and have more of a quality of life
right.
schedule.
So here's what I'm going to say. First, I'm going to
okay.
say this real quick.
Okay.
I can't comment on that because I have really strict things from the board in terms of how political I can be
oh.
on certain subjects, and I don't
okay.
think that my board chair would appreciate me commenting on that, especially with my position on it. So I will just say that it's a capitalist society. The industry needs to be capitalist
yeah.
based, and that means people need to compete. People need to get paid a living wage. They need to make choices. It's all about personal choices. If you want to make more money, work in the front of the house. You don't have to work in the back of the house.
Well, how about how about with a former guest and good friend of our of the show, Jacob Bohm. He runs Snap P. Mm-hmm. He said this on the podcast, so I'm not speaking out of turn. He pays his employees a livable wage, and we worked with him while we did the pop-up, the six-night banquet event, which was crazy, but it was a lot of people. Now, the back of the house is also the front of the house.
Correct.
Everybody does everything in that
right.
team.
Correct.
They all get paid the same amount.
Innovating. And innovating.
Then,
exactly.
Right.
Innovating.
Then
change the pie. Change the way we do business. That's what I'm talking about.
He has a tip jar at the end.
That's
as
right.
people are walking out and people are
don't,
like, well,
it's
that
not
was
about
the greatest
regulation.
Thing.
It's not about regulating this. It's not about regulating the industry. It's about people innovating and being competitive. That's what it's about.
Right.
So it's not about the government saying, oh, we have to make this change. Change never happens from the government. It comes from the ground up.
No.
PCG is a grassroots effort because the change happens on the ground, not in the government. So I want to say two things, too, real quick before I lose a chance to. One, we need to be talking to kids younger and younger about this industry and the opportunity in this industry. So PCG is partnered with CMS for that reason. So Charlotte Mecklenburg Schools.
Okay.
So Charlotte Mecklenburg has 11 culinary trade programs. We are involved in those trade programs. And the reason that we're there is because we want to show that these kids, there is a path to a career that doesn't require college.
Mm-hmm.
This whole college bullshit that everybody needs a degree and everyone's sunk in their student loan debt is a joke.
Mm-hmm.
It's the biggest fleecing of the youth of this country.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to demonstrate that there are opportunities and pathways that do not require a degree, and culinary is definitely one of them. Hospitality is definitely one of them.
Yeah.
So we are working diligently on that front. The other thing that I wanted to say, you know, we have our food and beverage symposium March 17th at Johnson & Wales every year. This year, we've always done a food and beverage track and a business track. We are adding a wellness track this year specifically to address stress management, mental health management, sobriety. So we want to make sure that people are talking about not just living wages. We need to talk about this culinary industry as a whole being very toxic for people's lifestyles frequently. We need to put that in people's faces, and we need to start making the changes with the leaders of restaurant groups, with chefs, to trickle down the trickle-down effect so that this is not perpetually creating burnout, drug addiction, suicide. It's crazy. It's
quality
a really right. So there's a lot going on, but hopefully we can address some of this at the Food and Beverage Symposium.
So people listening right now,
yes.
What is the first action plan if you could have them do whatever they need to do? Like, do they need to join the PCG? Do they need to join local food banks? What is the first action that you want?
Piedmont Culinary Guild is by invitation only. That's how we manage our growth and also how we make sure that the right people are involved. So the thing that I would do a call to action is, one, shop at the damn farmer's market every single week. Support small growers. Get out there and spend 10% of your income with a local grower. That's it.
The
if you spend $100.
I love that.
Yeah, the $100 that you spend at the grocery store, spend $10 at the farmer's market. That's it. That impact, if everyone was doing it, would be enormous for our community. So the second thing is PCG, we take donations. Those donations go into our general fund to help us run the programs that we do with CMS, with Novant Bariatric Unit, teaching people how to cook after post-op. So we have a lot of programs that we're trying to roll out, and we're on a minimum, like, limited budget. I refuse to go down the grant road. I feel like a nonprofit should be supported by community, or it should go out of business. So we are 100% membership fee-based, and that's what they can do. Donate.
Well,
shop at the farmer's market.
I have one more question that I have to ask, so you might have to push back the music because we're getting played off the stage. So
I'm giving you 2 minutes, Matt.
All right, 2 minutes. Here's the uphill battle in terms of changing the consumer, and when I think about in my mind, how are we going to do this? Because it's all tied in. So if I'm a regular shopper, I'm not in the culinary world, but okay, I like to go to the farmer's market. Sure, I like to support local. How can I justify, and I know that it's not the real price of food, but if I'm feeding a family and on a, how can I justify that I go to the grocery store, I see a whole chicken, it says North Carolina raised chicken, and it's $7.99
well,
or
$8.99. You won't find it will say North Carolina raised. You won't see that on a package. But yes, I understand what you're saying.
It says something to that effect.
I went to Lowe's the other day and they made it look like it was so close and it was like $1.99 a pound. I'm like, how is that possible?
It's not.
Yeah.
It's a Tyson or a Purdue product.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Yeah, go ahead.
Maybe. And maybe they found farmers here. But and then I go to the, like you said, the farmer's market, and a whole chicken is
$20.
$20. So how do we get that closer?
So
the first thing is, here's
the thing with local food. One, consumers buying meat in this country, they are used to seeing meat that is thawed in a styrofoam package with plastic on the top of it. They go to the farmer's market. It's frozen. It comes in a cryovac pack, and it has an ugly sticker on it from the USDA or from the North Carolina Agriculture Department. So it doesn't look like what you buy in the grocery store. I had somebody walk up to a farmer's market booth, ask for fresh chicken. The farmer put the chicken on the table, and he was like, oh, no, I want fresh, not frozen, and he walked away. And I went and grabbed him. I was like, oh, what you meant to say is thawed. You want thawed chicken because this is actually fresher than what you buy at the grocery store. Mm. So we have to educate people about every single aspect of the food system, right? So when we talk about cost, especially on proteins, you eat less meat. I buy all local meat for my household, all of it. Mm-hmm. When you buy all local meat, you don't eat as much meat because it's expensive.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to eat more vegetables.
Yeah.
Oh my God, what's going to happen to the community? We become healthier. We're supporting local food economy. We get rid of like all these crazy diseases that have to do that are all food related, by the way.
Yeah.
So think of the possibility if everyone was eating less meat, fresh vegetables, and shopping at the farmer's market and building community around food, preserving the food shed. You know, preserving the food shed. Circle the wagons on the food shed right now, people. You know, circle the damn wagons.
I think you said it best. I think the most is 10%. Go take the $10 out of every $100 you were going to spend at the grocery store and spend it at the farmer's market. That's a very achievable thing.
Eat less meat, eat more vegetables, and circle the wagons. Let's save our food shed. We have to work together to do that.
And it's just, it tastes better. You're going to win. If the end user wins, we get all of our stuff like Bella Bean, you know, former guest of the show, JB DeMent, who has Bella Bean Organics from Coon Rock Farms. She delivers all of her eggs to our house. We still do that. It's been 2-3 years. We've been doing it that way. It's better product. It's better for you. And you're giving back to the community that's working hard to be for you. So we all win.
Yeah. Well, everybody, thank you, Chris,
thank
so much
you
for being
so
here.
Much for
Rachel,
having me.
Please be quiet. You were talking way too much on this episode. everybody, spend $10 or 10% of your grocery store budget at your local farmer's market. Look into the Piedmont Culinary Guild. You will eat and drink very, very merrily.
For listening to the NCF&B podcast. And if you've stuck with us this long, review us on iTunes and remember, 5 stars are encouraged.